and the different locations on the map. So we have been looking at Ephesus, the letter to the church at Ephesus, chapter 2, and we have looked that one over. And then we have started in on the letter to the church at Smyrna. And so that's the one that we're going to be looking at next. And these first three are almost in a line from Ephesus to Smyrna, Pergamon, straight north and south. But we're going to be looking at the one at Smyrna here and finishing that one this morning. To the angel of the church in Smyrna write, "These things saith the first and the last, who was dead and lived again." And we pointed out that this expression of the first and the last is used of God in the Old Testament in Isaiah 41:4, and Isaiah 44:6, and Isaiah 48:12. In all three of those passages, it is applied to God Himself. So for Jesus to be appropriating this language and referring to Himself, then this means He is claiming identity with the one that it is applied to in Isaiah, which is God. So here is the divine one. And He died and lived again. So the idea of the sacrificial death, the crucifixion, this is who He is. This is why He is standing in the middle of the lampstands. He's the one who has done what it takes to be there where He is. And He has all authority and so on. He says, "I know your tribulation and your poverty." And then adds in parenthesis, "but you are rich." Which of course means you are rich spiritually. Because the idea of the tribulation and the poverty has to do with physical things. And so He says, "I know your tribulation and your poverty, and the blasphemy of them that say they are Jews and they are not." So in that verse, you look at the three things He says, "I know," your tribulation, your poverty, and then the blasphemy. Two of those things are traits of Smyrna, of the church at Smyrna. And one of them is the corresponding trait in the enemies that has caused these things. So it is the blasphemy of them that say they are Jews and they are not that has caused the tribulation and the poverty of the church at Smyrna. So it's just interesting that in the three things He mentions that He knows the cause and He knows the effect. And so when He says that say they are Jews and they are not but are a synagogue of Satan, I have no doubt in my mind that this is a reference to Jews, physical Jews. He says they say they are Jews but they are not, meaning they are not spiritually Jews. They are not the Israel of God, as Paul said in Galatians chapter 6. So they are not the Israel of God. These are men who have blasphemed, just like we remember in the days of Jesus. Just like we remember in the preaching of Paul at various synagogues that he went to. So here the Jews are causing the people at Smyrna great difficulties. And so instead of being the Israel of God, they are a synagogue of Satan. Because they have placed themselves in the camp of the devil. And are allowing him to use them and their efforts to further his cause. All right, so that's about where we got to. Now, verse 10. "Fear not the things which thou art about to suffer." This thing about fear in the Bible is an interesting point. A lot of passages that talk about fear. Now, for example, in Hebrews 11, the writer makes the point that the parents of Moses, not fearing the commandment of the king, hid Moses for 3 months. And so you'd say, so they weren't afraid? Well, the point is not that they had no fear, no concern at all about the command of the king and Moses and what would happen to him. But the point is that they did not allow their fear to move them to do the wrong thing. Or they did not allow their fear to cause them not to do the thing they should have done. In that case, they should have preserved the life of their son Moses. And even though there was danger in their effort to do so, their fear did not keep them from doing what they should do. And so when the Lord talks to us about being afraid, He knows that if there is not the recognition of danger, then you can't have courage. Courage doesn't play where there is no fear. But what he's saying is, do not let your fear deter you. Don't let your fear swerve you aside. Don't let your fear take over you to the point that you don't do what you need to do. And that's a tremendous principle. Because throughout the years, how many problems have come because people did not do what they should have done because they were afraid. So he says, fear not the things which thou art about to suffer. And I think that in the context, he's going to make the point that there's a good outcome to this, whichever way it plays out. When you're facing tribulation, if you are in the Lord, then it's going to play out well either way. And he's going to reassure them. Fear not the things that you are about to suffer. Behold, the devil is about to cast some of you into prison, that you may be tried. You may be put to the test. And you shall have tribulation 10 days. Be thou faithful unto death, and I will give thee the crown of life. Now, my attitude about most things like this 10 days is that I don't have a clue specifically what that's talking about. I think there are some general ideas that we can gain, that it is not an indefinite period that's never going to have an end. If it were going to be that kind of thing, he would not use a distinct number, 10. We could say 10 is used in the Scripture numbers of times for the idea of a complete number. There are several numbers that are used like that, 7 and 10 and 12. But beyond that, I really don't know. I think that he is saying that there's going to be a distinct period of time here. You will be facing this persecution. Remember, this is real. This church is real. This situation is real. But he is not giving a literal, you know, it'll happen for 10 days. But perhaps the idea is that it will be for a distinct period and it won't go on forever. Therefore, what can you do? You can survive. You can make it. So don't give up hope. Instead, the emphasis should be on, be thou faithful unto death, and I will give thee the crown of life. Now, throughout the years, this expression has been used in several different ways. One way is that as long as you live, from birth until 85 or 90 or 95, you just be faithful and keep on all the way until you die. But actually, in this context, the idea is that the degree of your suffering is in view. You are to be faithful to what point of suffering? Till it gets scary, till it gets painful, till you lose stuff, you lose your possessions. You know, do you see? It's kind of like we're upping the thing here, coming up on the graph. So how high up on the graph do we come in determining not to give up? Unto what? Death. Even if it kills you. So the death here is the measure of the willingness to sacrifice, the measure of the willingness to devote oneself. And so that's what he's telling them, that you're facing a situation in which you are about to suffer and you're going to undergo tribulations. And don't you think that by his saying, be faithful unto death, implies that death may very well be the thing that is required of the people here in their suffering? And we know that that did happen. So he is encouraging them because they're going to have a reward. Verse 11, he that hath an ear, let him hear what the Spirit saith to the churches. Remember, we referred to Ezekiel 3, where that point is made and perhaps is the germ of the idea that is then used so often by Jesus and is used here in Revelation also very often. He that hath an ear, let him hear what the Spirit saith to the churches. He that overcometh shall not be hurt of the second death. Now, in this context, the overcoming is a particularly poignant thing. Because if you look back in the letter to the church at Ephesus, there isn't anything in it that is signifying the facing of physical death. That's not the point there. But here, they're facing physical death, and they're facing the dangers of persecution that might intimidate them, that might deter them from doing what they need to do. So they need to overcome. And the one that overcomes may, in overcoming, die. But if he dies, he won't die. What kind of death? The second death, the spiritual death. And I believe in the book of Revelation, the idea of the second death is the idea of when once you die physically, then you find yourself in torment. And you therefore are spiritually dead forever with no reprieve, just as you died physically. So you die spiritually and find yourself forever in that situation. So he's just basically saying that the one who overcomes the trials of this life, the persecutions, whatever, even the threat of death, if he overcomes, then he is not going to be lost eternally. He is going to be saved. And no matter what happens to you in this life, as long as you are saved, what does Paul call it? Our light affliction. Our light affliction. If we overcome, if we succeed in overcoming and receive the great reward, the reward is going to be so great that it will make whatever affliction we faced light. And not only is that true so far as persecution is concerned, but it's true so far as just suffering in general is concerned as well. One of the things that we're going to get into when we get through with the letters to the churches is that the Lord is going to deal with the fact that as Christians we are subject to forces that include not only persecution, but the other forces of life that the Christian must deal with also, as anyone who is a citizen of this world, who lives on this globe, is going to face. And so the point is, we overcome them. As Christians, we deal with them, we overcome them. Yes, Marty? Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes. That's right. That's a good point. Keep your focus. That's right. Good illustration there with Peter. So he's telling them, keep your focus. And that, and you know, now we say that here again. I'm aware of this in my thinking, and I believe you have this in your thinking, that we're not careful. We'll say, you know, overcoming, that's a good idea, right? What about my overcoming? See, I've got things to overcome. That's personal. You have things to overcome. That's personal. And one thing I want us to do as we go through here is to realize that though these letters were written to churches 2,000 years ago, the principles are as alive as they were when they were still, when the sounds of the vision were still vibrating in the air in John's ears. The principles are still valid. So we need to keep our focus. And what that means is to realize that as I face the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune in this life, whatever they may be, whether it is of sickness, pain, persecution, the fear, the threat of death, whatever that may be, we've got to hang in there, be faithful, do not be overcome, but overcome. And so that's the thing we need to bear in mind. And if you haven't ever had anything like that, then you may say, right. But if you haven't ever had anything like that, just wait. You will. You will. It will happen. So we need to get these lessons overcome. The bottom line is that the promise is made in every case to him that overcometh. So that's what we've got to focus on. All right. Yeah, go ahead, Bill. Yes.
There may be some things there are.
Yes.
But I may face a challenge that nobody else does.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I've got to do.
Exactly.
Along with any outside question.
That's right. That's right. It'll be a set of individual circumstances and problems and everything. But whatever they are, overcoming is the name of the game. That's what Jesus did, is it not? All right, let's look at the letter now to the angel of the church at Pergamum. Okay? All right, so Tracy, could you? There we go. All right, now you see how Pergamum is straight north. So now this is the third one, the third. Now from here, when we get through Pergamum, then we're going to kind of curve around heading to the east and the southeast. And I don't have arrows, but I'm just going to mention that if you went on from Pergamum, Thyatira, Sardis, Philadelphia, Laodicea. So that just a rough U-shape even of the seven churches that are there. Okay. All right, so Pergamum, to the angel of the church in Pergamum write, "These things saith he that hath a sharp two-edged sword." Remember, where does that description come from? Chapter 1. Everybody with me on that? Now, I want you to make a note of that. And remember, every one of these self-designations, as Jesus says, now, remember, this is who I am. Every one of them comes from that chapter 1 description of the glorified Christ. So when he talks about, here's the one who has the sharp two-edged sword. I like to go back, and as we did the last time, talk about Isaiah 49, where you have made my mouth a sharp sword. And so the idea for this sword coming from the mouth of Jesus. And we're also going to note the corresponding idea, which is the rod of iron. And Isaiah 11:4 talks about the rod of my mouth. So that actually both the figure of the rod and the sword have to do with the word of Jesus and the authority of that word. And I believe that the difference is that the rod signifies the power to enforce. And I think that the sharp sword signifies the idea of punishment or judgment for one who disregards that authority. So those two ideas are very, very closely related. And they're very closely related in Scripture. In fact, turn over to Revelation 19. In Revelation 19 and verse 15. Now, though this idea is found in numerous places in the Bible, this is the only verse that I know of where the two ideas of the rod and the sword are in the same verse. And here you can see the relationship of the two ideas. "And out of his mouth proceedeth a sharp sword, that with it he should smite the nations, and he shall rule them with a rod of iron." See that? So here are the two ideas that are actually joined together in the same verse. And they signify the authority of Jesus to rule and the authority of Jesus to judge. And he has that power. He has that authority. So when he's telling the church at Pergamum, "These things saith he that hath a sharp two-edged sword," that's what he's reminding them of. Now some will point out that Pergamum was a place that was proud of its long connection with the Romans. King Attalus III of the kingdom of Phrygia, in his will, bequeathed his entire kingdom to the Romans when he died. The Romans had helped him drive Antiochus III out of his kingdom, and so when he died, he left his kingdom to the Romans. I think that probably one of the reasons why he did it is to avoid the civil war and bickering, but another is because he also probably said it'd be better that I give it to him than let him what? Than let him take it. But I think it was a good move politically, militarily, for Pergamum. But so some have made the point that Pergamum would have thought of herself as a particular seat of the power of the Roman emperor and so on. And so it may be that Jesus is here pointing out that though the emperor has power, I'm the one that has the sharp two-edged sword. So whether that's what he was saying or not, in other words, I don't know if that was his intent or not, but that fact is true, isn't it? So it's interesting to me, and you know, I like to make a distinction between what I can prove is stated in the language here and what may be a true idea, but I'm not sure that's what his intent was. So I like to kind of distinguish between those two things. I am convinced that Jesus was here talking about his authority and his power, particularly his power to judge. But whether he was doing that because Pergamum was particularly associated with the emperor, I mean with the nation of Rome, the empire of Rome, I'm not sure about that. And there are several things that we can point out about the background and character of these cities, and that may contribute something, definitely. And I like to bring out some of those points, but I'm a little hesitant to say that I can prove that that's what Jesus had in mind. So it's good for us to think about those things, but I think we need to exercise a little caution in being dogmatic and saying, now, that's what he had in mind. That's exactly why he said that. So I'm just wanting to express that caution. Yes. And they don't distinguish between whether it's their slant or whether this is a legitimate conclusion that can be drawn from the language itself. Now, one of the points made about Pergamum, verse 13, I know where you dwell, even where Satan's throne is. From what I have read, it is true that Pergamum was a place of particular emphasis upon all kinds of worship. The emperor worship had its devotees there. The Greek Zeus and Athena under the name of Diana, they had their devotees. And Dionysius and Aesculapius, who were gods of Asiatic origin. Now, Asiatic means over in this little province of Asia. We're not talking about Asia reaching all the way to China. I wish that I could just, you know, make sure that everybody knows that when we're studying the Bible and I talk about Asia, almost always we're talking about this little province that's just right across the Aegean up there, that province where all of those cities are mentioned there. So that's the Asia. All right, so Dionysius and Aesculapius were of Asiatic origin. In a way, that's just saying the Greeks lived over in Asia. But anyway, now you start thinking about all of that stuff that was going on there at Pergamum. And maybe that could be why you would say even where Satan's throne is. Because where there is that much emphasis on that many different kinds of the cults of the day, it would certainly be appropriate to say that. That may be why he said it. I don't know for sure, but that would at least fit. So in spite of all of this pagan idolatry of all kinds and the emperor worship that's going on there, you hold fast my name and did not deny my faith, even in the days of Antipas, my witness, my faithful one who was killed among you where Satan dwelleth. So once again, the idea of where Satan dwelleth. You know, that goes with the idea of where Satan's throne is. Satan is viewed in this letter as having a particularly strong influence in Pergamum. Now, I want to ask, would you think that that would be a fair statement to make about a letter in which he says, I know where you live, even where Satan's throne is? I mean, can you imagine what kind of a place it would be for Satan to have his throne there? So it looks to me like he is emphasizing there's some particularly deplorable things here about Pergamum. Yeah, Mike? Yeah, yeah. He was on the job every day, wasn't he? Satan does not take spring break. He does not sleep at night. Yes, Tom? Yes. That's right. All right, and we're going to look at those in just a moment there in verse 14 and 15. But for one more moment, let's look here at this idea, his commendation. Remember the self-designation, then the commendation. I know where you dwell. You hold fast my name. You did not deny my faith. Even in the days of Antipas, my witness, my faithful one who was killed among you where Satan dwells. We don't know who Antipas was. Now, there was a Herod who was a son of Herod the Great, who was Herod Antipas. But that word has nothing to do. That name has nothing to do. He would not have been this Antipas. You know, we all realize that, don't we? That would have been the Antipas that had John the Baptist killed. He's the Antipas that saw Jesus at the trial and wanted to see him do a miracle, which in his mind, I think, was the idea of seeing him do a trick. And so this Antipas has nothing to do with him. I have no reason to think this was anybody else, like this is a symbolic name. I have no idea why he would have used this as a symbolic name. So I think that this was for real. That this was a person who was named Antipas. But we don't know anything about him except that what does this indicate happened to him? He was killed for his testimony, wasn't he? So he was a martyr. Yes, he died for his faith. My witness, my faithful one. All right, so I commend you. I mean, that would be a pretty bad thing. You know, you think about how you would react if you heard there had been a government crackdown and somebody here had been taken and killed because of his faith. The next assembly, what would you be thinking? Now, you might not be thinking, I don't think I'm going to go. But what would come to your mind? You know, you would be saying, if I stay involved, now what's going to happen? Buford? I may be next. Now what am I going to do? You know, we Americans have not faced this kind of situation. But it would be only a step away. You know, it's like so many things that as we study history, we think, oh, there's no way that could happen. When it's one step, only one step away. So if it did happen, you know, what would we do? We need to be determined, as much as in us lieth at this point, that we would be faithful too. And I appreciate, he says, I appreciate your holding fast my name, not denying my faith, even in the days when one of you was put to death. That's good. They are commended.
We pray for Satan. We pray that these things will happen to him. I wonder if he's praying enough for ourselves to be faithful even when those things that might happen do happen. Or could happen, might happen to us. Pray for ourselves to be faithful and strong. And not so much to keep those things away.
I think you're right. And another thing, do you dread, Do you dread primarily the thought that persecution might come upon us? Or do you dread primarily the thought that if it did, I might be unfaithful? There are two things to dread, kind of in keeping with what you said there, Bill. And I think that a lot of times in our prayers, we reflect the fact that the thing we're most afraid of is that persecution occur. But the thing we ought to be more afraid of is that if it did occur, I might give up. I might become unfaithful. So it is good for us to think about these things, because these churches were undergoing trials and persecutions, even though that's not the point made in every one of the letters, yet that was going on. Yes, that's right. Count it all joy when you fall into manifold temptations, knowing that the proving of your faith worketh patience, steadfastness. It's easy to keep on when it's fun. When is it not easy to keep on? Right. When the cost is high. All right, let's look at something else now in this letter. I have a few things against thee, because you have there some that hold the teaching of Balaam, who taught Balak to cast a stumbling block before the children of Israel, to eat things sacrificed to idols, and to commit fornication. So hast thou also some that hold the teaching of the Nicolaitans in like manner. So I believe that when he describes the situation with Balaam there, he is using that situation to say, you have some there who are like Balaam and what he did with Balak, the king of Moab. And they are those that are the followers of this the Nicolaitans, some that hold the teaching of the Nicolaitans in like manner. Okay, so we talked about that a little bit back in the letter to the church at Ephesus, because they had some of these Nicolaitans there. And we pointed out that we have no specific information about these Nicolaitans except what is said here. But I talked to you a little bit last time about the Gnostics that were coming to flourish here at the end of the first century. But also, let's go back for a moment in our minds to 1 Corinthians 8 and 1 Corinthians 10, where Paul was dealing with similar matters. But when he's talking here about eating things sacrificed to idols, he is not talking about that which would contradict what his servant Paul has written by the inspiration of the Holy Spirit. And remember that Paul said that if you were invited to an unbeliever's house, and the unbeliever had gone to the shambles, which is a very unfortunate translation, but it'd be the idea of the meat market, and the meat that he bought was the meat that had been left from the idol sacrifice, the rituals, brought down and sold on the street as merely meat. So he had bought the meat, taken it home, prepared the meal, and you have been invited. Now, when you sit there and you look at that meat, what did Paul say? Do not what? Don't ask any questions. In other words, do not feel compelled to sit there and say, excuse me, sir, was this meat offered to an idol up there on the hill? No, don't ask any questions, because you're there eating it as just food. And remember, he also said that if someone, and I use the example, a hypothetical example of suppose there was a Christian serving as a servant in that house, may have even been a slave in that house, and he knows you, not socially, but he knows you as a brother. And so he comes by and finds occasion to whisper to you, that meat was offered to an idol. Then what did Paul say about eating that meat? Don't eat it, not for conscience sake, but for the sake of the one that told you, to keep him from stumbling and all that. So that is not the situation that is being talked about here. The situation being talked about here is where the eating of the meat sacrificed to idols and the fornication are both things that are being practiced. So the idea is a participation in the idol worship itself and the eating of the meat that's involved. And remember that in 1 Corinthians 10, when Paul dealt with that concept, remember that he didn't deal so much with that concept in chapter 8, but he dealt with it extensively in chapter 10. And one of the first points he made was, you may be saying, huh, it won't bother me a bit. I could sit right there at the feet of that idol and I could go through all that. It wouldn't bother me a bit. You remember what the first thing he does in 1 Corinthians 10 is? He says, now the Israelites had a lot of advantages. And what happened to them? They fell. Now let him that thinketh he stands take heed lest he... In other words, he was warning the Corinthians about their overconfidence. And then he went on to point out that that worship that is rendered to the idols is received by what? By the devils. You cannot partake of it. No matter how much knowledge you have, you cannot partake of it. You can't go through it. You can't do it. Well, here were people at Pergamum who were saying to the contrary. Sure, it's okay. Just like Balaam told Balak to encourage the Israelites to commit fornication. I told that story briefly last time, but I think it's something that we need to be sure we have in our minds. Now, one time when I was in the Czech Republic the last time, the second week I spent in a lot of individual studies with the people that I had worked with 14, 15 years ago over there. And one of the points that Mira's wife, Ruzinka, wanted to know about was... She wanted to know about this thing about Balaam. She had heard these ideas about Balaam teaching Balak to cast the stumbling block and everything like that. She wanted to know, how did she know that was true? Because she didn't know the passages. So I showed her the passages. But one of the passages that I want you to be sure that you know about is in Numbers 31. It is in Numbers 31 that we find the Old Testament revelation of the fact that what Balaam did was he suggested to Balak, the king of Moab, that the Midianite women go down into the camp and seduce the Israelites into worshiping their false gods. And the way they did it involved ritual fornication. So here is Balaam who did that. He encouraged that. And that story is in Numbers 22, 23, 24. And then in chapter 25, the story of the Midianite women going down into the camp and seducing the Israelites to worship their idols. And then in chapter 31, the vengeance of God is taken upon the Midianites because of their part in this. And I say that because in the passage itself, it does not say the vengeance of the Israelites. It doesn't say the vengeance of Moses. It says the vengeance of God, the vengeance of the Lord was taken against Midian. This was an act thought of, originated, and executed by none other than the Lord. And so it's in that chapter 31 that the point is made that Balaam was found among those Midianites. And he was killed. And in the process, it is told how he had encouraged Balak. He had found a way to get his money. He had found a way to get the Israelites cursed. And so here is Balaam who taught Balak to cast a stumbling block before the children of Israel, to eat things sacrificed to idols and to commit fornication. Now you have some there among you who are doing the same thing. Now the connection with Gnosticism, I mention again, the idea of Gnosticism. The word itself comes from a Greek word that means knowledge. And we'll see reflections of this more than once in these letters because... the reference to the deep things of Satan, as they're wont to say. The deep, that word, the deep, that was a favorite word of Gnostics. And knowledge, and because they viewed themselves as a spiritual elite that lived on another level above the herd. So they could do things and they knew things that gave them special abilities and kind of permission to do things that other people couldn't do because they had, they had this elite kind of knowledge up here. They knew the deep things. Yes?
They also emphasized the idea of being the enlightened one.
That's right.
And that's the reason that John...
Oh, yeah.
Right
Yes. Yes.
We are connected with the light.
That's right. I believe that you can find in all of the writings of John, the Gospel, 1st, 2nd, 3rd, and the book of Revelation, I believe you can find in all of those that John was dealing with this Gnosticism which had arisen at that time. Okay, well, has the second bell rung? Anyone heard a bell ring? I haven't heard one. All right, so we'll go on for a moment. So, yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
Well, yes, he went like 20 miles an hour into it. Yeah, it'd be wrong, but if you just go on 50, it's okay.
Yeah, that's right.
Thank you.
Oh, me. It's like I'm driving down the road 53 miles an hour. Speed limit says 50. Somebody goes whizzing by me. 65, boy, I mean, he just goes whizzing by me. Oh, my outrage just flares. Look at that fella. Look at him breaking the law. Man, look at that. And then I have to say, wait a minute. What does your speedometer say? And then I say, yeah, I'm afraid I don't like anybody passing me. And it's not the idea, the outrage of him breaking the law. So we do have to be careful. I'm using that as an illustration of that idea. Okay, let's go ahead and stop here.